Charles Osgood, it is an honor to talk to you. Your career has been so distinguished that no matter how many people I interview or how many years I've been doing this, when I meet someone like you in an interview situation, I actually get nervous. So, and that's really hard. That's hard to do.
Well, you deal with an awful lot of people that have been doing this a long time, and I'm certainly proud to be one of those who's been doing it for a very long time.
Yeah, we've both been around a while. As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you something kind of funny. I'm sitting here, in my hand is a copy of the fifth issue of Talkers magazine, published in September of 1990. The fifth issue. Now Talkers is 26 years, going on 27 years old. So this was from the first year, and you were the Talkers interview. That was the last time that you and I spoke, 26 years ago. And the first
guy, I remember every word.
I'm sure you do. The first question, I read it, and it's very interesting to look back at something from 26 years ago. And the first question I asked you was, and I guess it's really appropriate now, but from the reverse side, you were doing radio and television. You hadn't started the Sunday show on TV yet, which of course went on to you hosted it, I think, longer than anybody. But
that was only 22 years that I did.
But the first question was, now that you are a multimedia practitioner, where does radio fit into your priorities? 26 years later.
I think that's an easy one. I've always thought of myself not as a television guy who does a little radio on the side, but I have always thought of myself as mainly a radio guy, and then there's this other thing that I did for the last 22 years, which turns out to be Sunday morning, which is has been very, very successful and very, very, very popular. So I don't feel as if there's very much change in my life. I'm still working in the same office and studio, and I'm still welcome to mosey by and see how things are going on Sunday morning. They're gonna have a luncheon tomorrow, and I'm invited. So I think we leave on very good terms.
Well, I remember in the last show of the Sunday morning show, Jane Pauley, who is following you in that role, said to you, "Please don't be a stranger. You know, please come by." And you said, "I promise." And it was very touching.
I think they really mean that. You know, because it's you don't work with people for 22 years unless you have a bad relationship. You still wish them well, and it's going to be terrific. I think my absence will be more felt by me than by anybody else. But they're old buddies, and we like each other a lot.
Did you find when it was announced that you were leaving there that because it's such a busy world and everything is so noisy these days, that a lot of people thought you were retiring from radio as well?
Yes, people assumed that, but that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And as I've told a lot of people, I would have been delighted to do both shows forever. But there is a little thing called reality that it intrudes sometimes on what we'd wish, and I will be, when this contract runs out, I'd be 84, and I've been dealing mostly with 3-year contracts, and they would have to be talking about dealing with an 87 year old anchor person at the end of that, and that just doesn't exist in television today.
Well, we're breaking new ground. I have to say that being 83 years old and doing a daily radio feature and having been on the radio for so many years and even TV for more than two decades and having it be a news event when you've retired, that's a tremendous inspiration to so many other folks who are getting on in years. It really is. And I mean, there was once a time perhaps it would have been shocking, but today it's not that unusual. You've got to feel good about that, being an inspiration.
I think it's one of the great things about radio, really. And I think I have always believed that radio is a superior medium. And having had a chance to work in both, I can speak with some experience there. It seems to me that radio is indeed the theater of the mind. You know, Rod Serling, who worked in radio before he got involved with the Twilight Zone on television, used to say that the one thing about writing for radio is that if you wrote the words, "Once there was a castle on a hill," that there would be, I don't know, 5 million castles built. Each, you know, each listener would build the castle in his mind.
Right.
Whereas in television, you can have to show a picture of a television set, and it's the same one for everybody because that's the only picture you have. Or you'd have to build a set that looked like that's second best as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the theater of the mind has no limits. It's an infinite stage, infinite to the left, infinite to the right, before you, behind you, above you. And it's up to the artist, to the performer, especially in the kind of spoken word radio that we are involved in. It's up to the performer and your imagination and your skill with the language to make it as special and as spectacular as possible. There's no limit. And therein lies the art.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. I guess you probably knew Stan Freberg.
Sure.
And he used to do these commercials, you know, for radio, talking about how you could actually drop a 1,000-ton marshmallow in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and it's okay. You can actually make that happen in radio. And you can't in television because television is so hopelessly literal.
Also, they have done psychological studies on this. They've actually tested this out, that when the human brain receives a signal through the eye, it actually goes to a different part of the brain than it does when it receives a signal through the ear, and that the ear signal has more impact. I don't know all the details of that, but it definitely was weighed in the direction of radio as being extremely persuasive. That's not to undermine or discount the power of TV. I mean, television's a very powerful medium. But I worry that because of the screen that is on every listening and viewing device today, everything is on computer screens, that radio being the only medium from the 20th century that doesn't need a screen might get lost in the shuffle, and people may not realize how wonderful the potential is of really doing meaningful broadcasting in the audio sense.
Yes, I think that's and as somebody that, you know, that now has quite a lot of experience in television, you say, why are we doing this? And I said, because we got a picture. Everything hangs on the picture. Radio, everything hangs on the word. And I think that the old and inaccurate saying that a picture is worth 1,000 words is exactly wrong. I think a word is, the right word, is 1,000 times more powerful than
very, very interesting.
Some picture of, a literal picture of it, of the thing that you're talking about.
When did you first start using the expression, I'll be seeing you or I'll see you on the radio?
Well, that's maybe too long a story to get into, but I was doing a TV piece there was a cartoonist who did a series about a forester guy who worked in the woods, and a little girl wrote him a letter and said, "You shouldn't do that. The man should not be smoking a pipe in the woods because he could start a forest fire." And so he went around, erased the pipe from the character's mouth, and spent a certain amount of time doing this. So my mother used to use an expression called, "I'll see you in the funny papers." That was a reference to what they used to call cartoons.
I know.
Comic strips. And so I wrote that, "I'll see you in the funny papers," and I thought, wait a minute, I'm not going to see them on the newspaper. They're going to see me on the radio. So I thought I would say that. I'll see you on the radio.
Right.
And I like the sound of that because I think radio is more visual than television.
And in this case, you're seeing them. So it took it even one step more into a cerebral dimension, you know. That.
Well, also, I think that's right. You're absolutely right about that. And come to think of it, what people say is, I'll see you.
Or you'll see me. You'll see me on the radio, or you'll hear me on the radio. But it's very provocative, and yet it's very simple. I didn't realize it was a long, complicated story. I'm sorry to tell you, but actually, that's a very interesting that it went back to your childhood.
Yes. Well, but everything does in a way. You know, the way you hear something depends on your lifetime of experience, and in my case, that's a lot of long time ago.
Well, one of the reasons I mentioned I was nervous before this conversation, and that's kind of a good feeling to get nervous before I do something in the broadcast medium, because I've been doing it for 50 years, so it takes a lot to do me.
How long I've been at CBS.
Yeah.
It'll be 50 years.
Yeah, you started in 71, I believe. And
that's right.
My first job in radio where I got paid was 1967. So, you know, you and I have been around for a while. But the point I'm making is, I look at a career like yours, and we have, you know, a little chunk of time to talk. It's like, where do you begin? How do you know, do we do a biography? Do we do a philosophy? You know, the theory? There's so many different angles to getting the essence of you without it just being something that person could find on Wikipedia or Google, you know.
Yes.
So I want to tap in a little bit to some of the theory and some of the things that are going on today, and tap into your wisdom and your observations about it. But I must ask you one question about the past, because an executive at Westwood One, who you know very well, Bart Tesler, said to me, "You've got to ask Charles how he was involved in inventing pay TV." So I'm going to ask you that.
Okay, well, it's true that the first pay television station in the United States was in Hartford, Connecticut, and that happened in 1963. I was working at the Good Music Station in Washington, WGMS, and as the program director, I was attending a meeting in New York of all the RKO General stations. And I found out about this and was chatting with a guy who was in charge of it from New York. And he said, "Would you be interested in this?" And I said, "I think it's fascinating. The idea that, you know, commercial radio, commercial television, you measure the value of the audience in mills. I mean, one person is worth less than a penny." Mm-hmm. I think that may have changed since then, but I think it's not very much. If you could get a dime per viewer, it would multiply the revenue tremendously, and give a lot of things that have no place to go. I mean, you know, things that classical music, for example, it has huge following. I used to live right across the street from Carnegie Hall, and you can see people pouring in there night after night after night, and yet television can't make way for something like that. I mean, commercial television. So I thought that was my perspective, because I was working for this classical music station. But that's also true of certain sports that have a big following, but you can't put them on television because the audience is not big enough. I mean, to be able to cater to those people. So anyway, I was made the general manager of WHCT, subscription television, we called it, in Hartford, Connecticut. And I was there for about a year during its first year of operation, and it was an experiment that I would have to say failed, because it was not right for the time. Color was just coming in very strong, and our service was invented by Zenith, and we were experimenting using this system, but it was exclusively black and white. So, but I had the experience of actually working with people who were paying for the television that they were getting, who ordered a special translator to be put on their TV sets, and they paid something. It didn't have to be a lot of money. If you wanted to watch a movie, you could you could not do what's possible today, which is to watch any one of 1,000 movies. But we tell you that some certain movie, Sunrise at Campobello, was going to be on Thursday night at 6 o'clock or 7 or whatever it was, and then you could see that. But as I say, it was a somewhat flawed technically. But I found out that people would be willing to pay for things that they couldn't get otherwise, and I also learned that I enjoyed being on the air much more than I did being an executive. I was not cut out to be hiring and firing and managing business affairs. Although I was an economics major, but I was glad to get back on the air.
I'm sure, though, that experience as a general manager and a programmer came in handy in the years to follow when you became a talent and, went through the various machinations of performing on air.
Yeah, I think it did. But mainly, it's very useful to learn about the things that you're good at. And it's also very useful to learn the things that you don't really particularly enjoy. Mm. And especially when there are special problems, and you're getting attention, but not always the best kind. And some people, the Theater Owners of America, for example, were trying to tell people that there goes free television as we know it, because what they're going to do is you're not going to be able to watch a baseball game without paying for it. You're not going to be able to to see the things that you now enjoy on television, because the potential of revenue is so much bigger when you're talking about pay per view. But that did not give me as much pleasure as the idea of being part of the creative side.
And right.
I love working in newsrooms, and you hear people who are producers and writers and things like that, and I love to sit in the middle of the newsroom, and I would steal shamelessly from stuff that was just being said out there. I'd say that's very funny, I would do that. Then I found out that if in your own office, which I now have, and where I do most of my writing, sometimes you wish you could. It's the people in this business that make it so damn interesting. It's because people have a good sense of humor, and they're smart. And I think that's a great thing that we'll always have in the broadcasting industry.
Well, that's something that keeps me going. I have to say, oh my gosh! I mean, over the years that I've been in this business, the friendships and even the enemieships. I look back on some of the people I've had problems with, and I miss them, or I've mended fences. You know how that is. Time heals wounds. Sometimes you wind up with more in common with somebody that you used to compete with. You're the last two guys standing. You're suddenly, hey, we're a club, as opposed to,
well,
you know.
It's a little bit like warfare. You have to find that there's a difference between a friendship and an enemyship.
Life is funny, and as you get older and you've been through a lot of experiences, you learn things that just weren't apparent at one time. Not to belabor the pay TV thing, but just one other point on that. Did you mention it was 1963 that you were involved in that? That was way ahead of the curve. I remember in the late 60s, even in the 70s, there was talk about pay TV and said, oh, it'll never happen. People will never pay for television. I remember living in Los Angeles in the 70s. They had a thing called the Z Channel, which was a channel that you would pay for to get movies. It was sort of a precursor or a local representation of what went on to become HBO, Home Box Office, Showtime, and all those. And those were very exotic services, sort of the way satellite radio was when people first talking about it. Well, people pay to hear, radio. It takes years sometimes for these cultural changes to take root. What I find today, and you mentioned something, people will pay for things they want. I don't think anything is free anymore. Even free radio, I think one of the most valuable commodities that we have in our culture today is time. And to get people to spend time, even for something free, is like pulling teeth, because time has a value like it's never had before. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the reasons that they have been able to do satellite radio successfully is that they sold it along with automobiles.
Exactly.
You know, you buy your car. They would say, it'll cost you, and it's nothing compared to the cost of the car. So you'd say, fine. And then at some point it runs out, but by that time you've gotten used to it, and people can drive across the country and hear things from beginning to end. You can listen to a Wagner opera if you want.
Right, and not have to change stations.
No, that's right, and try to find something that's just on the borderline of being out of reach.
Now, you mentioned something in this conversation a few minutes ago that was intriguing to me. You said that you liked being in newsrooms, and you liked creativity. You liked the creativity of being in the performance side of radio or TV, and you liked to be in newsrooms. One of the things that you have done that you basically stand alone at this. I mean, maybe people have done various types of it, but you really are the champion of bringing poetry and music to the dissemination of news. That I find to be one of the many things that you should be known for and credited for as being original and being a breakthrough. Tell us a bit about that.
Thank you. There is a true story about the word exclusive, which is widely overused in broadcasting, exclusive or breaking news and all that sort of stuff. In this particular instance, somebody had an exclusive story. It was out of Italy, and so the editor on the desk said, "You exclusive, congratulations." And this was in the wire talk, because that's how you used to communicate with foreign bureaus. And 2 hours later, he said, "You still exclusive? Tell me again what your source was." and then again, "You still exclusive? If you still exclusive tomorrow, you fired."
Right.
The fact that you're the only one who does something may mean that nobody else wants to do it or was willing to take the chance.
In your case, it's not everybody could get away with it. You maintained, they talk in radio about X factor, which means that intangible quality that makes somebody special and stand out. And the gentle tone of your voice, the universality of your wisdom, and the unusualness of your poetry and your music, I think were inimitable. So I don't think it was that nobody else wanted to do it. I don't know if anybody else could do it. And
I know I couldn't make a living playing the piano because I'm not good enough.
Well, you certainly figured out a way to do it, sort of the way Jack Benny used his violin playing as a very productive part of his act.
Maury Amsterdam with a cello and that's true, but I think together you're a package, and it takes a while before the audience gets used to the idea. Oh yeah, sometimes he does that. He waxes poetic, but not everybody thinks it's a good idea. I get a call one time. I was not here, and so the desk took the call, and they mentioned that guy says that if Osgood keeps doing these poems, you better watch it because I'm going to kill him. Well, they didn't take that. They took that very seriously. Mm. And for a time, they would assign somebody to meet my car, and as it pulled up in the morning, in the wee hours of the morning, because I was doing live morning shows. But then they soon forgot, and they continued doing that. I told that to a friend. He said, "Well, if somebody did murder you," he said, "I think a jury might find it as justifiable homicide."
my gosh. Well, look. In today's world with the internet and social media, you could go on and preach total goodness and love and peace and happiness and still have people curse you out and tell you how horrible you are. I mean, this is a world where just to be out there, you're going to get negative feedback. It's part of the culture.
So. Yes, and I think, you know, looking back on the way political leaders would use the media, not television, of course, back in FDR's time, but he used radio so well in his fireside chats, and Winston Churchill in the talks that he made, really he was a central force in winning the war because of the way that his talks would inspire the whole country to stay behind him, and they would not, you know, we would fight them on the beaches, you know, all that kind of business, and now when you hear what so-called political leaders say and how they say it, that is not an improvement over those people.
It's very interesting you say that. I'm thinking back also to the relatively recent movie, The King's Speech, which you probably saw.
Yeah.
Excellent movie, and it touched upon things of that nature. People like FDR and people like Winston Churchill and the public figures of those days, and I'm not quite sure why this has happened, but they were something you don't hear anymore. The word is orators. They practiced oratory, which is another form of spoken communication, like singing. You know, they were orators.
Yeah.
Today,
well, I knew of Everett McKinley Dirksen very well.
He was an orator.
In fact, I wrote. He had a popular record at one point, which was reciting something that I had done.
Yes.
When I was in the United States Army Band, it was a march that had a trio section, and it was called Gallant Men. And he said my words, and the record made, you know, it was one of the top, top 25.
It was on top 40 radio.
It was.
Yeah, yeah. That was the days when one radio station would play everything from Percy Faith to the Beatles and a novelty record and Everett Dirksen. it was just a very different time.
But it was not funny.
It was inspirational.
It was a political, I mean, it was a patriotic statement,
yes.
Really. And I wrote it when I was being the announcer for the United States Army Band. And I learned during this time, by the way, that he, Everett Dirksen and Lyndon Johnson, for quite some time, took turns as either majority leader or minority leader of the Senate. And they were very effective. And at the end of every single day, they used to go to whoever was the office of whoever was the majority leader, because there was a bar in that office, and they would pour themselves a couple of stiff bourbons. They were both bourbon drinkers, and figure out how they could help one another. How many votes do you need on that dam? Well, I think I could, I could come up with that, but you know what I need, and they would talk just as you know, horse traders, but they got things done.
Well, you've just opened the door. You've just opened the door to a whole realm of topics and thoughts about today's world. Do you think it was more effective when the left and the right, the Democrats, the Republicans, opposing forces cooperated that way and were friends after work?
Of course I do. And if you spend the whole day demonizing somebody, it's so much harder to then come to some understanding. Because I think partly it's because of the way the best political advice is you'd much rather something bad happen to your opponent or something exposed that your opponent did, no matter how long ago it was, than to have something good about happen for your own causes.
Or for the country.
I think it's very, very, very sad. These debates have made me. I can't tell you how bad I feel about all of that.
I think there's widespread depression about it. I mean, I think that you know, there are a lot of people out there that are all caught up in it. A lot of people out there will make a great argument for one candidate or one position over the other. Yep. And part of that is demonizing the other side. You'll notice that people don't defend their position. They just turn around and demonize the other side. But
That's exactly right.
Yeah, but I think there's a whole realm of people, and we're going to find out after Election Day just what the statistics are on this, if enough people vote, that are just disgusted and depressed. Depression is a very strong word. I found myself the next day after the second debate, just to timestamp that this conversation, because it will exist for a long time out there, I found myself depressed the next day, depressed, saddened by it.
No, and I think that's it's almost like, you want your side to win, but this is not a baseball game or a football game or something. This is we're choosing people who are going to run the country, and I think it's become, you know, whoever wins this mudslinging contest is the one who wins. You get to be the president of the United States for 4 years. I mean. That really is a very sad thing, and I think and then when you get into office, you try to seize and hold on to whatever advantage you can get from make it more likely that you'll hold on to your job.
Well, back before we entered this particular chapter of culture, there was a period of grace. There was a period of the honeymoon period. They gave the president some time to get his or her, if it were the case, footing. And then, you know, as you got into the momentum and the rhythm of the presidency, and you start to approach the 4-year point, then the politics began again. It was considered to be uncouth. It was considered to be impolite to get political immediately. But I think with Clinton, it just started immediately. He told me that. He said, "I can't believe it. The day I was president, all of a sudden it was like re-election time." And It is a peculiar change, and although I am a huge advocate for free speech and the First Amendment, I believe that's the foundation upon which this country is built. I also believe, though, that with the First Amendment comes responsibility and the proper execution of it. Let's talk about the atmosphere in newsrooms. You've seen newsrooms for many, many years. Is it getting tougher to be an objective journalism organization in this environment than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Yes, I'm afraid so. And I think part of that is because people like to listen to people who they're going to believe in, so already believe in. So you'd rather have what you want to hear is your own opinion, not to learn about anything, but to sort of reinforce your already existing point of view. And to be partisan it doesn't take very long before a good story is one that makes somebody else look bad. And that's I think that's very unfortunate. And I think we have to do something about it. I mean, here's a phenomenon I think that you probably noticed. That during they take polls. How do people feel about Congress? Mm-hmm. Well, no, I mean, that's way down there along with how do you feel about news, news media. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't like Congress very much at all. But they usually reelect their own congressman.
Well, there is so much contradiction. The outsider runs as an outsider, becomes an insider. You can't be an outsider once you're elected. You're an insider. So when people say, "I want an outsider in there," well, it's just a new insider. Yeah. The whole thing about being unbiased, well, now everything is accused of being biased. If I said to you, "The sky is blue, Charles," you'd say you'd look up, and if it's blue, you'd agree. But in today's world, no, it's not. You're biased. I don't see it as blue. It's pink. Oh, really? In other words, facts, the whole idea of what is a fact is now a subjective determination.
I remember there was a time back in there when we could not agree on what sex meant.
Exactly. Right. Right. Well, having sex. What does that mean? Well,
what is that anyway?
It's fascinating looking back at all that. But you said something else, and I'm going to wrap this up in a moment or two because I know you've been up since very early, and I empathize with that, having spent many years doing morning radio. You mentioned likening political opinion to rooting for a sports team. And I think that politics, to a great degree, has become a spectator sport. A lot of people don't really even know how it affects their own life. They just know what they like. They like the uniform. They like the ego of it. They like the camaraderie of it. And they don't know the difference between what it'll mean in their life if this person actually gets elected or this party gets power, how it affects them economically, how it affects them in terms of life and death, et cetera. Yep. I have found that we as a culture, not you, not necessarily me, not individuals, but we as a culture seem to put more of a prize on victory than we do on truth. That ultimately it comes down to, are you seeking truth or are you seeking victory at the expense of truth? And I think that is the...
By scoring points against the other,
yes,
your opponent. And that I think, if I may, I hope you'll let me say this last thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the last debate, the best part of it, the best part of it came out with the very, very last question. And there was almost a gasp in the audience. They've been warned not to applaud, and in this particular case, I'm sure they were waved to not respond this way. But here was the question: Could you both tell me if there is anything at all that you respect about your opponent? And there was, oh my God, that hasn't happened in any of these debates. And so, if you respect something about your opponent, please tell us now what it is.
Yeah, it was a good conclusion. And it was a perfect capper to the way it opened with basically, how do you feel about being so disgusting in front of our children? Which I paraphrased it. Do you remember the first, it took them a lot of, as Governor Wallace would say, and no pun intended, it took a lot of pussyfooting around before before they got into it. Charles Osgood, it has been a pleasure speaking to you. There is no way within a half hour we could even cover a fraction of the material that's locked in your head. And I just want to congratulate you on such an amazing career. And thank you for sharing some time with us.